It's widely accepted that the 20th century was the bloodiest in history and that the 21st is off to a depressingly competitive start. So it was startling to read Harvard professor Steven Pinker's argument that, in fact, we probably live at the most peaceful time in history. In the current issue of the New Republic, he writes that global violence has fallen steadily since the Enlightenment in the 17th century and dropped again in the middle of the 20th. Yes, there's Darfur and Abu Ghraib, Rwanda and Iraq, but he says there is less genocide, war, and torture than ever. If you wonder why he thinks so, or if you'd like to challenge his argument, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email is talk@npr.org. Steven Pinker is Johnstone Family Professor at Harvard University. He joins us by phone from his office. Good to speak with you.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
And what happened in the Enlightenment that changed things?
Well, the most obvious thing is that there was a sharp decrease in homicides, according to the best statistics collected over the centuries. There was the beginning of a debate that culminated in the abolition of slavery. There was a reduction in torture and mutilation and other forms of cruel punishment, as well as capital punishment for what we would consider trivial crimes. So a number of things happened around that time, and no one really knows why, but one of the possible reasons is that governments became more centralized, and so people didn't have to engage in cycles of vendetta to keep themselves secure from their neighbors. They could count on the government to do it. Also, there may have been more of a tendency to put yourself in another person's shoes, to imagine that there, but for fortune, go I. And that makes it's a little harder to torture someone or mutilate them or kill them for a trivial reason if you realize that could have been me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the broadening of horizons starting in the Enlightenment set that process in motion.
And there was also a theory at the time of civilization, of progress, of things improving. But a lot of people would say that argument was really had its apex in the Victorian, or I guess the Edwardian age, 100 years ago. It ended in the bloody trenches of the Western Front during the First World War.
That's right. The whole idea of man's rise from savagery and barbarism and the progress of civilization seems kind of corny today. But I think there was something to it, and there were reasons why people in the Victorian and Edwardian eras embraced it, namely that in much of the world beyond the reach of civilization and government, there were rates of homicide and feuding and war that even dwarfed those of the 20th century in Europe and the Americas. So, for example, there are in a survey of rates of violence in pre-state societies, hunter-gatherer and forager societies in the Amazon rainforest and New Guinea highlands, turns up statistics like 15% to 60% of the men die at the hands of other men. If you were to apply rates anywhere close to that to Europe during the 20th century, the number of people killed in the world wars would have been 2 billion rather than perhaps 100 million.
But that's, of course, as you point out in your piece, it's an argument to say it's somehow better if 1% of a huge population dies than 50% of a small one.
That's right, and that's a kind of moral imponderable. If you add up all the suffering, it's clearly greater in the 20th century. But on the other hand, if you add up all of the people who lived lives and enjoyed all of the delights of life without getting killed, it would be orders of magnitude greater as well.
And you also argue that this goes against the currents of what you would describe as a political correctness.
That's right. It goes against the idea that native peoples are harmonious and peaceable, and that the Europeans introduced warfare to them, which I believe is wrong. It is wrong. That's what the historical sources clearly show. And it goes against the idea that that there's something sick in modern civilization, that our institutions have thrown us against one another and led to a decline from some romantic Garden of Eden in which we originated.
You also suggest it challenges the political correctness of those who look to the Bible for some of their examples.
Yes, that's political correctness from the opposite end of the political spectrum, because clearly the religious right wants us to look at the Bible as a source of our moral values. But if you actually read the thing, you have in passage after passage God telling the Israelites to massacre every last woman and child of a village that they were invading. Occasionally, for some villages, they were allowed to spare the cute virgins so they could rape them or take them as second or third wives. But it's gruesome stuff, and of course it's not specific to the Israelites. That's just what people's did in those days, they were projecting it onto God, but that's simply the history of conquest in early civilizations.
We're talking with Steven Pinker about an article he wrote in the current issue of the New Republic called A History of Violence. We're getting nicer every day. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And let's talk with Julie. Julie calling us from Fairfax in California.
Yeah, I wanted to ask the speaker if he thinks perhaps one of the reasons there's the perception that there's more violence is that our morality has gotten much higher, and we now call things violent that we used to take for granted. For example, hitting children.
Absolutely. I think that one of the reasons that our perception is out of whack with reality is that our standards rise more quickly than our behavior. It's probably because of the rise of standards that the behavior does change, but it takes a while to catch up. There were moral arguments against slavery before slavery was in fact abolished. And once we reach one milestone, such as abolishing official slavery, we naturally set our sights on the next one. So we live in an era in which, for example, dodgeball is considered a form of violence in kids, and in which your waiter will tell you, reassure you that your chicken led a happy life. This is a wonderful development, but with those standards rising so quickly, we're going to look at the violence that still exists, and by those standards, we're give ourselves a very poor report card.
Yeah, you describe it in the piece as saying, yes, Abu Ghraib still happens, and as reprehensible as torture is. The fact that it is so widely denounced and universally despised should be taken as a sign of progress.
Absolutely. And another example is the capital punishment debate in this country, where some vicious murderers are put to death fairly painlessly after a legal process that takes a dozen years. There are reasons to deplore that, but by the standards of history, where you would have people being gruesomely tortured after a 10-minute trial for criticizing the king or insulting a priest, we've come a long way.
Thank you. That answers my question very nicely.
Thank you very much for the call, Julie. Let's see if we can talk now with Barry. Barry's with us from Farmington Hills. Where's that?
Michigan.
Michigan. Go ahead, please.
Thanks for taking my call. For the most part, I agree with your assertion, except as much as I hate to bring it up, World War II was certainly a very bloody conflict, and the Holocaust was probably the most systematic genocide in the history of man. So I was curious on what your thoughts are about the 20th century.
Yes, certainly this general trend has lots of spikes and zigzags superimposed on the general decline. Although genocide probably was pretty common throughout human history, I mean, it is sanctioned in the Bible and it's written about in the early histories of every civilization where they proudly say how they slaughtered every last man, woman, and child of whatever territory they invaded. There is something particularly horrifying about the mobilization of high technology and a vast transportation network in the heart of what we thought was one of the most civilized countries in the world. So there's no doubt that there were specific horrors of World War II, the dropping of the atomic bombs, the Nazi Holocaust, and there's no way one could minimize that. But it would be a mistake to think that this was the first genocide in history. Sadly, there were many more before that, and the world's population, of course, was much smaller.
Okay.
Larry, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Barry, excuse me. I apologize for that. Even so, in the past decades, we've seen, well, what's going on in Darfur now, Rwanda, hundreds of thousands of people slaughtered, the constant wars in Central Africa, what's going on in the Middle East today. People would say this is terrible stuff.
It is terrible stuff. There's no denying that it's terrible stuff, and any war is one war too many. But the number of wars in Africa has gone down since the end of the Cold War. It's kind of gruesome it's kind of almost obscene to say, well, yeah, but there's only one genocide going on now. That's kind of a slack standard. Nonetheless, one genocide is better than four or five genocides. And people who count these things, such as the Human Security Report people from the University of British Columbia, say that the number of genocides has gone down since the Cold War, into the Cold War, as has the number of wars in worldwide, but in particular in Africa. There were more of them in the 70s than there are now.
We're talking with Steven Pinker, who is the Johnstone Family Professor at Harvard University. 800-989-8255 if you'd care to join the conversation. 800-989-TALK, email talk at npr.org. His piece, A History of Violence, appears in the current issue of The New Republic. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. And let's get Matt on the line. Matt with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering if there are good systemic reasons why these declines may be happening, and I'm coming from a caution that Reinhold Niebuhr gave us in the last century, Immoral Man, Immoral Society, that our behavior in groups is far more immoral than it is as individuals, and whether we really have any kind of controls that say that this is a trend that will continue or it could go the other way tomorrow.
Both good questions. Humans can do an awful lot of damage in groups, and we're not unique among animals in terms of the violence we carry out, but we're pretty far out there in terms of how much violence we carry out in groups, in the equivalents of armies and so on. And also, there's no guarantee that this will continue, especially in an age where you've got national leaders with pre-modern sensibilities combined with very, very modern weapons. That is an unprecedented combination, to be sure. In terms of the systemic causes, I think that's the question that we ought to answer. What is it that's been pushing in this direction, and can we identify those factors and try to increase them? I mentioned two at the beginning of the show, namely the possibility that if you have a disinterested government, then you can remove the incentive to have to constantly retaliate and keep up blood feuds and intimidate your neighbors, do it to them before they do it to you. This is, of course, the idea of Thomas Hobbes's Leviathan, mm-hmm. that life in a state of nature was nasty, brutish, and short. But if you have a sovereign that keeps people from each other's throats, then you have a chance at more peaceable living. And another one was increased empathy. The cosmopolitan sensibility that says there's nothing unique about me. I could be that person there, so I can't bring it on myself to torture or kill him. Mm-hmm. Another possibility suggested by Robert Wright is that as networks of trade become more efficient, other people become more valuable alive than dead. And as we can transport things and spread ideas more easily, we're inextricably woven into bigger networks of cooperation. I mean, to put it crudely, one of the, as he puts it, of the many reasons that I don't think we should bomb the Japanese, one of them is that they built my minivan. And another reason is simply the general logic of the golden rule. When you deal with someone and you have to talk to them and convince them why they shouldn't harm you, you can't very well go about harming them and unless you're a blatant hypocrite. And as we have more communication, as we start to justify what we do, think about it, talk to people, we get put on an escalator that forces us to include not just our own family among those whose interests we value, but our own nation, the entire human race, perhaps even other species. And we are getting nicer to animals as, I think, part of this process.
Matt, thanks for the call. And let's see if we can get one more call in. Jim. Jim with us from Athens, Ohio.
Hi.
Hi.
My question is whether or not we are possibly lulling ourselves into false security, thinking that things are getting better, and statistically they may be, and then the big, you know, hammer may come down either through terrorism with nuclear or, you know, something much greater than a 9/11. That's my question, and I can take it off the air. Thanks.
Jim, thank you.
I agree with that, that this is certainly not a reason to lull ourselves into complacency. A few loose nukes could do unprecedented damage. It kind of relates to the remark I made earlier that we've got a combination of pre-Enlightenment leaders with state-of-the-art weapons, and the world hasn't seen that combination before. So there could be a lot of damage. We can't relax. But we can, first of all, be thankful for what we have accomplished, and second of all, try to figure out what made things better and see if we can't apply more of the same.
And your critics, again, going back to this, would say you're taking a very Eurocentric point of view here.
Well, it is. I think, even though it's politically incorrect to say that there's anything good about Anglo-American civilization, I think there is something good about it. Anglo-American and Dutch, that is where the Enlightenment started. It is the first region to see the reduction of violence. And I don't think it's egocentric or chauvinistic to say that some parts of the world are more peaceable than others. It doesn't mean, of course, we could impose this on others by force, as the lessons of Iraq seem to be teaching us. But I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, let's look at to see what works. If it happens to be us, then we shouldn't be ashamed of it. I think the Enlightenment was a good thing.
Steven Pinker, thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Steven Pinker, the Johnstone Family Professor at Harvard University. Again, his article, A History of Violence, appears in the March 19th issue of The New Republic, which is on your newsstands now, if they still have newsstands. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.